Hussein alayhi salam. So this is another connection between these two imams, the fact that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will take revenge for the blood of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Let's go back to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam talking about Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. The concept of ghaiba of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam or his occultation is mentioned by the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, and the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. So many years before the occultation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, the other members of the Ahlul Bayt, they have explained about his occultation.
Well, so let's take a pause button over here, and we will continue this discussion in our next session. Okay. Dear listeners, we would want you to ponder on the topic until we get back with another episode. And Dr. Karimi, we extend our gratitude towards you for such useful insights. Thank you so much for listening. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Midstream.
After the Israeli aggression on the Jenin camp and amidst silence by the Jenin Brigade and the Palestinian factions, President of the Palestinian Authority Mahmoud Abbas visited the city of Jenin, apparently as part of a plan to regain control of the city. The visit, which is Abbas's first since he assumed office 17 years ago, sparked popular criticism of the authority in light of the enormity of the security measures that it surrounded it. Many residents sarcastically asked about the position of these forces in protecting the Palestinian citizens who were subjected to barbaric attacks just a few days ago, amid clear anger towards Ramallah, which was evident by chants in support of the Jenin Battalion. Before Abbas's arrival, 300 members of the Presidential Guard arrived in the city to secure the visit, not against any Israeli threats, but against whom exactly? No one knows. Meanwhile, the leadership of the Fatah movement mobilized its masses to show a kind of popular rally around Abu Mazen. However, local sources revealed that the number of those who participated in the reception of Abbas was meager and was estimated at hundreds, including citizens, individuals, and members of the security services affiliated with the authority itself. On the purpose of the visit, sources in the authority revealed that Abbas's move falls within the plan drawn up by security leaders to regain control of the Jenin camp, which includes strengthening the presence and power of the security services and carrying out a campaign of arrests against members of the Hamas and Islamic Jihad movements. So the man came in after 50 hours of brutal fighting, destruction, displacement, yet nonetheless unwavering victory to finish what Israel failed to achieve. The plan, which was approved by Abbas after his meeting with the leaders of the security services last week in Ramallah, requires starting the process of confiscating weapons, preventing armed manifestations in the camp, and carrying out arrest operations for a list of people from the city of Jenin in the first stage, up to the implementation of arrests in Jenin camp as a second stage. In return, Netanyahu is to present proposals for facilities in the interest of the Palestinian Authority, including the establishment of an industrial zone near Hebron, the granting of soft loans, the scheduling of Palestinian debts, the provision of fuel exemptions, the advancement of the date for the transfer of tax revenues, as well as an increase in working hours on the Al-Karama crossing, and returning the permits of the VIP visitors to the authority officials. Such an honor for Mahmoud Abbas, really. I'll just stop here before what I might say becomes inappropriate for broadcast. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas arrived last Wednesday in the city of Jenin and its camp to see the conditions of the citizens and the progress of work in the reconstruction of the camp after the recent Israeli attacks on the camp during Operation Jenin Force a few weeks ago. This step comes at a time when the Palestinian Authority and behind it the Fatah movement has become more aware of their declining popularity among the Palestinians, particularly in the city of Jenin and its camp. In addition to dozens of cases of collision between the security services against citizens and resistance fighters in the West Bank. To discuss this issue with us from the occupied Al-Quds is Mr. Adnan Najee, political commentator and head of the Beit Al-Maqdis news agency. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Adnan. Now, the Palestinian Authority aspires to restore this popularity through Abu Mazen's visit, and perhaps to open some sort of a new page with the local community in the city of Jenin and its camp as well, and to support the security forces inside the city. Now, they want to strengthen their position, especially after the emergence of the Palestinian resistance in the camp victorious as a retaliation against the aggression against the camp by the Zionists. Now, they are obviously reinforced by the popular environment, by the support of the people, and we saw that maybe the Palestinian Authority wants to grab that, hijack that. How do you assess the visit of Mahmoud Abbas last week to Jenin?
In the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful. Mr. Mahmoud Abbas's visit to Jenin government, specifically in the Jenin camp, is due to two main reasons, in my opinion. The first reason is to improve the bad image that has been imprinted in the minds of the Palestinian street in general and the Arab international public opinion. After the Palestinian Authority system, supervised by Mr. Mahmoud Abbas, has been shaken, especially after the recent visit by members of the Fatah Central Committee to the Jenin camp, during which the camp residents expelled those delegates on behalf of Fatah and the Palestinian National Authority. Therefore, the visit, in my opinion, is among the failed moves by the Palestinian Authority to try to restore its position in the West Bank. In light of the unprecedented failure of the Palestinian political leadership to defend its besieged people everywhere in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and dispersed in the countries of the diaspora.
One very important issue, Mr. Adnan, was that Abbas's visit raises questions about the approach that the authority will be making towards the city of Jenin and the Jenin camp in specific in the upcoming next phase, because considering the occupation's pressure on it to play more of a role that the occupation itself cannot play, they're pushing Mahmoud Abbas to play that role, and the facilities that the enemy government intends and promises to provide to the Palestinian Authority in order to strengthen it and maybe help it regain its some of its prestige, let's say, inside of the city and the camp. Does that insinuate a possibility of a clash between the Palestinian security forces and the Palestinian resistance factions, especially in Jenin?
I believe that there is a state of awareness prevailing among the segments of Palestinian society in the West Bank. There is a popular mood that rejects the shedding of Palestinian blood among the sons of the security services and the sons of the resistance. Attempts to shed Palestinian blood are not new attempts. Not as long as the Zionist occupation, along with the United States of America, works hard to see a clash of Palestinian blood on the ground through internal fighting. But we as Palestinians who support the line of resistance count on the awareness of the resistance fighters to prevent us from being drawn into a series of spilled blood inside the Palestinian interior. But honestly, everything is possible. There is a fierce attack by the Palestinian security forces to detain the resistance fighters in all the governance of the West Bank. There are restrictions on the resistance fighters everywhere in the West Bank. Unfortunately, this increases the Palestinian streets' congestion towards the PA's security services. But as I said, we are counting on the awareness of the Palestinian population, so as not to be dragged into such battles, even if some try to drag us into them. And I mean here specifically the occupation and the Arab Zionists, and behind them the United States of America.
Well, Mr. Annan, the Palestinian security sources revealed that there was a regional American-Israeli agreement with the Palestinian authorities that was forged in Jordan and in Egypt, followed by intensive contacts to confront the growing resistance forces, especially in the West Bank. Many measures have been agreed upon with the Palestinian authorities, sadly, which include increasing deployment of the Palestinian Authority forces in Jenin and maybe entering the camp in the upcoming period, which leads to reducing the activity of the resistance. We hope that it would reduce the activity of the resistance in the camp. How do you think that will work out if the Palestinian Authority actually goes ahead and implements what the Zionist entity wants?
I believe that this agreement, which we have read in various media, is not new. The Palestinian National Authority has always concluded agreements with the occupation under the auspices of the United States of America, and with the partnership and sponsorship of some Arab countries such as Jordan, Egypt, and the Arab normalization countries in the Persian Gulf. Thus, this matter is not new to the Palestinian people, and it is not surprising that this comes from such regimes and authorities whom themselves are aware that their job is to defend this usurping entity. As I said before, we are counting on awareness within the Palestinian street in order not to fall into the trap of internal fighting. Although we see on the ground that there are preparations on the part of the Palestinian Authority, with its security services and also with its economic and social arms, in order to control specifically the Nablus government and Jenin government in the north in order to eliminate resistance. In order to control specifically the Nablus government and Jenin government in the north in order to eliminate the resistance. This resistance, which has proven in the past days and even in the past months that it is difficult to defeat and difficult to break. There are attempts to destroy it through the attack initiated by the entirety of the Zionist entity, with more than 1,000 soldiers armed with all the weapons known to humanity in order to eliminate a few dozen young fighters, in a geographical area of less than 1 kilometer, but this entity failed. Therefore, the National Authority will not succeed, and agreements with Western countries will not succeed. And also, with the participation of the countries of normalization under the United States to eliminate the hawks of resistance in the occupied territories, a resistance that is not represented by a specific person or faction. Today it has become a culture and an idea spread among Palestinian people. The different segments of the Palestinian people have come to see the Jenin camp model and the old town model in Nablus as the model that must be followed in order to achieve our freedom from this occupation and reclaim our lands. Therefore, we count on the awareness of the Palestinian people and on the steadfastness of these resistance fighters. And we also count on the independent access in the region, which we call the axis of resistance. As long as this axis fully supports the Palestinian resistance, as long as it acts as the arm and back for the resistance fighters in Palestine and in the occupied land, then I believe that more internal solidarity between the axis of resistance and the Palestinian people will thwart the plans of the occupation, the plans of the Palestinian Authority, and the plans of Arab normalization countries who aim to eliminate the resistance in the occupied land.
Definitely. Well, Mr. Anan Najib, it's always a pleasure having you with us. Anan Najib, political commentator and head of the Bayt al-Maqdis News Agency. Thank you very much for your contribution to our show. Please, ladies and gents, stay tuned, because next we'll be talking about the relationship between Turkey and NATO. Before the last elections and the weeks and months that preceded them, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan threatened America, NATO, and the countries of the European Union and said more than once that he will not agree to let Sweden into the alliance. However, there was no real surprise that he retracted everything that he said, especially after his phone call with the U.S. President Joe Biden, who said a day after this call that he does support Turkey's accession to the European Union, but he thinks that this is a purely European matter. More details in this following report.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan surprised his allies in NATO before the NATO summit, which took place last week, by setting a new condition that seems difficult to achieve, which is opening the door to Turkey's entry into the European Union in exchange for Ankara opening the door to Sweden's entry into the alliance. Before the last elections and the weeks and months that preceded them, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan had resorted to issuing threats against the United States of America, the NATO, and the countries of the European Union, and said more than once that he will not agree to Sweden's accession to the alliance. No one was surprised, though, that he retracted everything that he said, especially after his phone call with President Biden, who said a day after this call, "We support Turkey's accession to the European Union, but this is a purely European matter." This is what Sweden's Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson also said after Erdogan agreed to his country's accession to the alliance, promising him to lift the ban on Swedish military sales to Turkey, with other non-binding promises to coordinate with Ankara in combating terrorism, which is meant by the Turkish Kurdistan Workers' Party PKK and the YPG. At a time when the diplomatic community is ruling out that Erdogan will receive any support from the European Union, which Turkey has been waiting at its gate for 70 years. Now, the most important aspect of Erdogan's position is his provocation of Russia 2 days before the NATO summit. President Erdogan extended an urgent and surprising invitation to Ukrainian President Zelensky to visit him in Istanbul, to return from there with five of the most infamous leaders of the fascist Azov group, whom Moscow handed over to Ankara as part of a prisoner exchange deal, but on the condition that they remain in Turkey until the end of the war. The second Turkish provocation came with the agreement signed between the two parties, which includes building a military complex to manufacture and develop Turkish drones inside Ukraine, in addition to other areas of military cooperation. As for the third provocation, it came when Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan met with the leaders of the Muslim minority of Turkish origin in the Crimea region, which Ankara considers occupied by the Russians. Erdogan's announcement of his support for Ukraine's accession to NATO is the most important indicator of a possible change in Ankara's policies towards Moscow. Meanwhile, President Putin, who had previously complained about similar Turkish positions, including Zelensky's non-compliance with the Istanbul Agreement regarding the withdrawal of Russian forces from Kiev in exchange for a comprehensive Russian-Turkish agreement and with Turkish guarantees, is highly expected to cancel his scheduled visit to Ankara next month. With a potential Russian position to respond to the unsurprising change in President Erdogan's position, it remains to be seen if Ankara in the next stage will be on Washington's side more than it is now with Moscow.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Istanbul is Mr. Hosni Mahalli, researcher in international relations and expert in Turkish affairs. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Mahalli. Now, controversy continues to escalate over Erdogan's sudden approval of Swedish membership in NATO, especially due to his connection between the accession of the Scandinavian country and the revival of Turkey's accession into the European Union. What is your take on such a maneuver by Mr. Erdogan? And do you think that Europe will allow Turkey, in, especially at such a unprecedented times in European history, to join the European Union?
There is no maneuver because, one, Turkey has been a member of NATO for 70 years. Two, Turkey is a strategic ally of the US. Three, NATO has about 30 bases inside Turkish territory. What President Erdogan did was nothing but internal propaganda to deceive the Turkish people, as is the case in most other issues with regard to foreign policy. When he threatened the Emirates, Saudi Arabia and Egypt, then he returned and asked them to reconcile with him. With regard to Sweden, when he threatened Sweden under the pretext that it supports terrorism, as Erdogan said, he meant the Kurdistan Workers' Party and the Kurdish and Syrian People's Protection Units, as well as the preacher Fethullah Gulen. Erdogan knows that those who support this terrorism are the United States of America before Sweden. America is the one who supports the Kurdish militias in the east of the Euphrates. America is the one who supports the Kurdish militias in the east of the Euphrates and occupies the east of the Euphrates. And regarding the preacher Fethullah Gulen, whom Erdogan accused of planning and supporting the failed coup in 2016, Fethullah Gulen resides in the United States of America itself. So this position is not a serious one for President Erdogan. And as I said, it is nothing but internal marketing on the basis of national religious and sectarian slogans to which the Turkish people are accustomed. To a point that the supporters and followers of Erdogan say that he is a world leader and the leader of the Arab and Islamic nation and whatnot, and that he is the heir of the Ottoman Caliphate. Even if he made a mistake, in their view, he knows why he made that mistake. That is, in their view, there must be an idea in President Erdogan's head, at least according to his followers and his supporters.
That's really interesting, because before the last elections and during the weeks and months that led to those elections, we heard Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, just as you said, threatening the United States of America, threatening the NATO, and also the countries of the European Union themselves, and said more than once that he will never accept Sweden into NATO. But how are his supporters and his foes as well? Because you just said that his supporters might give him some sort of benefit of the doubt of why he's doing what he's doing. But what about his foes? I mean, how are they receiving his sudden change of heart concerning NATO?
They never stand up to it. This issue or this question needs to be answered by conducting a social and psychological study of the followers and supporters of President Erdogan. Simply because there is no logic in the stances that President Erdogan has taken in recent years. As he threatens everyone, then returns and reconciles with everyone. Exactly as I said with regard to Saudi Arabia, the Emirates and Egypt. Even former US President Donald Trump in 2019 threatened Erdogan and sent him a message insulting him and literally telling him not to be stupid. But Erdogan ignored this message and begged the United States of America so that Trump would send him another message to visit the White House. This is the case now with President Biden, as when Erdogan agreed to Sweden joining NATO. He wished that President Biden would invite him to the White House, and he will soon be fulfilled, according to media reports. As for the biggest lie, it was when he said that there would be a reward for Turkey for it, allowing Sweden to join NATO. Which is that the doors of the European Union would be fully open to the Turks. The strange thing is that Erdogan's followers and supporters believe this, forgetting that Erdogan has no intention of joining the European Union because he does not believe it benefits him ideologically and religiously. Because he believes that he is the heir of the Ottoman Empire that occupied half of Europe. Therefore, this approach is of course not serious, because Turkey has been waiting at the gates of the European Union since 1963. I repeat, this issue requires a social and psychological study.
Something that is very interesting that came out of Mr. Erdogan with his newest position was the provocation against Russia. It seems like he's challenging Russia on purpose. I mean, two days before the NATO summit last week, he extended an urgent and very surprising invitation to the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, to visit him in Istanbul, and he gave him five of the most infamous Azov leaders who were handed to Turkey by Moscow, but the deal was that they will stay in Ankara till after the end of the war, but that did not happen as well. That was just a couple of many other provocations against Russia. How do you think this episode of insulting Russia will end?
I do not think that the relationship between Russia and Turkey will deteriorate and end, because there is a long history between Russia as an empire and later as the Soviet Union and between Turkey. The age of this relationship is about 500 years old and witnessed about 16 wars, during which the Russians won 11 wars and Turkey won 5 of them. With regard to the recent developments as mentioned in the question, this is not the only provocation. We know that there is a strategic military cooperation between Kiev and Ankara, especially in the matters of military drones. And especially During Zelensky's recent visit to Istanbul, it was agreed to manufacture Turkish drones inside Ukrainian territory. However, we must remember that the provocation, as it is called, about the Turkish position against the Russians is not new. We know how President Erdogan did not abide by the Skopje Agreement on the issue of Idlib and northern Syria, just as he did not abide by the Moscow Agreement of March 2020. Also, with regard to the withdrawal of terrorist elements from Idlib, as well as sitting at the negotiating table with President Assad. But as I said, Erdogan did not abide by this issue, just as he did not abide by the tripartite special agreement between Turkey, Azerbaijan, Armenia and Russia regarding the situation in the Caucasus. The Turkish army is now in the Caucasus and it is a provocative position against the Russians. Likewise, President Erdogan's policies in Central Asia, where the republics are of Turkish origin, and we know that these republics are indeed Russia's backyard. This is also one of President Erdogan's veiled provocations against Russia.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you think those would do with the upcoming visit of President Putin to Turkey? Do you think President Putin might cancel his visit to Istanbul?
I think so. Although there are intense efforts by President Erdogan to appease to President Putin to visit Turkey as soon as possible, so that at least it is not said that Erdogan is the one who spoiled the Turkish-Russian relationship. Because this relationship has many very important aspects, the most important of which are the 4 nuclear reactors that Russia is building inside Turkish lands. In addition to that, Russia covers about 50% of the gas consumed in Turkey. So Erdogan is trying at least to tidy up the issue until he can arrange the matter strategically and not tactically with the United States of America, especially after his expected visit there, as well as arranging the situation of the regional security after his ongoing visit now to Saudi Arabia, Qatar and the Emirates.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Hosni Mahalli is a researcher in international relations and expert in Turkish affairs. Thank you very much for joining us from Istanbul. It's an honor, sir, to have you with us to talk about these issues. Ladies and gents, thank you very much. I'll see you again next week on the Mideast Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
Imam Sadiq, peace be upon him, said, "Perform pilgrimage to Karbala, and don't stop doing this, for Karbala has embraced the best son of the prophets."
According to the Gaza Ministry of Social Development, 459 families were displaced as a result of the Israeli regime war. They are now homeless, totaling 2,516 people, including 1,180 children. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "On May 9th, the Zionist regime attacked Gaza with ferocity. For 5 days, it bombed the besieged Gaza Strip, killing 33 Palestinians and wounding hundreds more. Much of that horror, however, was not shown on television, especially in Western media. On May 13, 2023, the Naphan family received a phone call from the Zionist regime army, warning them of an imminent bombing of their residence, located in the neighborhood of Jabalia, in the besieged Gaza Strip. Falestine and Bilal Napan are both 35. They have four children with special needs. That harrowing call terrorized them. Falestine told the Palestine Chronicle, "We were having dinner when the Israeli army called us and ordered us to evacuate our house in 10 minutes. Falestine continued, "Gripped by fear, I hastily dressed myself on the staircase. I also forgot to wear my hijab." Her husband Bilal told us that his first thoughts were focused only on the children. He said, "We only had 10 minutes to leave our house. Even for a healthy person, this is hardly enough. Imagine for a person with disabilities. I was not even able to take their medications and wheelchairs with me." Bilal said, with the sadness of that moment still lingering. The Napan family's house, once filled with cherished memories, now lies in ruins. The family is now homeless. Falestine told us in tears, "Where can we seek refuge? My disabled children did not deserve such a fate." The Napan family remains without shelter, since none of their relatives' houses could accommodate their large number. The Banat family also fell victim to the devastating five-day Israeli regime attack on May 9th, which destroyed their three-story home. Faraj Banat, 38, is a father of six. During the latest war, he was at the funeral of a relative when he received a call from the Israeli regime army. "I received a call from an Israeli intelligence officer. He ordered me to return home, and he told me that he could see I was at a graveyard," Banat told the Palestine Chronicle. Banat told the officer that he is a simple farmer with no connection to any resistance movement. The Israeli regime officer, however, was adamant. He said, "Go back and evacuate your family within 10 minutes. Banat requested more time to gather his belongings or clothes before the bombing, but the Israeli regime officer refused. Then the Israeli regime officer asked him to warn his neighbors because they intended to target the entire square, a reference to the whole block of houses. The officer told Banat, "I will bomb your house and your two brothers' houses." The Israeli voice on the phone seemed bereft of any humanity. The house, in fact, all the houses were destroyed as promised by the Zionist regime officer. Banat said, "More than 10 families are now displaced. Why did they bomb any house? My house? Other people's houses? Where should we live now?" Their financial situation does not allow the Banat family to find an alternative housing solution. Therefore, the family is now living in a tent in front of their demolished home. In Beit Lahia, in the northern Gaza Strip, another family is experiencing similar trauma. On May 12th, two Israeli regime F-16 destroyed a building belonging to the Taha family. In fact, this is not the first time the family loses their home due to the Israeli regime bombing. Samir Taha, 62, told the Palestine Chronicle, "During the 2014 attack on Gaza, they bombed my home. Our family remained homeless for 2 days before we could rebuild our home. And now, after all of that suffering, the Israeli regime occupation bombed our home again." Samir's son, Mohammad, told us that they were also warned 10 minutes before the bombardment to evacuate. Mohammad said, "More than 42 people lived in this building. We began running outside without taking anything. This is not humane." Taha family plans to set up a tent in the proximity of their home until they are able to rebuild. Muhammad said, "Unfortunately, the tent does not protect us from cold and heat, nor is it able to protect us from stray dogs, but we have no alternative. I grew up in this home. I lived here and got married in it, but all our memories are lost now." In its continued attacks on the besieged Gaza Strip, the Zionist regime destroyed civilian infrastructure, buildings, and entire residential neighborhoods. Various international human rights organizations said that the Israeli regime has committed what amounts to war crimes. But this is what human rights experts often say. It neither prevented the Zionist regime from attacking and killing Palestinians, nor provided Palestinian victims with any justice or even shelter. Wafa News Agency also reported, according to the Gaza Ministry of Social Development, 459 families were displaced in the recent Israeli regime war. And according to these statistics, they are now homeless, totaling 2,516 people, including 1,180 children.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanting whisper. I say, why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. And we would like to actually express our condolences and sorrow and sadness for the martyrdom of, the master of the martyrs, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, peace be upon him. We're going to talk about some of the Islamic laws regarding the mourning ceremonies of Imam Hussein, or in commemoration of his martyrdom, and also Arba'in. Well, before that, let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Khamenei, and we'll be back. Don't go away. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad for For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hauza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my guest speaker, Sheikh Chawid, as always, answering my questions related to the month of Muharram and some of the Islamic laws regarding the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. Sheikh Chawid, what's the religious law about beating the drum or blowing the trumpet in the commemoration gatherings and or during the processions of the commemoration of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him?
Of course, in Iran, we see the mourners, they beat the drum and they blow the trumpet. And it's something ordinary. It's something very customary. Mm-hmm. And from a common view, from a common perspective, there isn't any objection to it. But, in other countries, as I see in some, for example, neighboring countries like Iraq, like India and Pakistan, and even Afghanistan, we see that people are beginning to copycat, you know, to imitate. And they don't tell the difference between drums and trumpets. And other musical instruments, they usually think that it's okay to use any kind of musical instruments because they don't tell the difference between drums and trumpets. And they think that it's okay to use any kind of sad music, even if any other musical instruments are being played. So, to be honest, we should first of all avoid using musical instruments. When it comes to blowing the trumpet, of course, beating the drum, there is no objection in it. Even if other nations start beating the drum and blowing the trumpet, there is no objection in it. But I'm afraid other people might start using musical instruments, as it's usually the case in with other people, because they look at Iran as a role model, thinking that whatever is done in Iran is okay, so it's permissible because it is a very religious country led by a faqih at the top. So beating the drum and blowing the trumpet are permissible per se.
Mm-hmm, I see. And likewise, flute, for example?
No, they cannot be permissible because flute, it's something else. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And okay, if flute comes into play, then there are other things that might be that people might start using, might start playing.
I see. Okay, well, there's another question I would like to ask you, sir. What's the ruling regarding lashing oneself with chains, as done by some Muslims?
Well, when we talk about chain, people usually perceive chain as chain only. There's nothing else added to it.
Mm.
But when we speak in a general fashion, if our audience is an Indian audience or a Pakistani audience, they understand something else.
Mm-hmm.
They think that chain is the very sword, the very, you know, knives that are attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I should reiterate and say that, okay, as far as beating or hitting ourselves with chains only, with chain, no sword involved, no knife or no blades, so it is permissible. And of course, it's a manifestation of grief. It's a manifestation of sadness. But there should not be knives attached to the chains. There should not. The mourning ceremonies should not involve any cutting tools to make our bodies bleed. So
mm-hmm.
that's what we should be careful about.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah. Let me go astray, 'cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jahad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawhid, our guest speaker, talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the sad month of Muharram and the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. Sheikh Javid, what's the ruling, the religious law about buying and selling on the 9th and 10th of Muharram, I mean Taswa and Ashura?
That's a very good question, because many people think that it is kind of, doing business and doing business on this day is haram. It can be haram if it is considered a kind of disregard to the whole event, the event of Muharram and Azadari. So, but in itself, it's not haram to buy or sell something. For example, on the day, on the 9th and 10th day of Muharram, you need to buy bread, you need to buy food and drink. And these are the essentials. These are the things you need. So if someone opens his shop, his business, with the very aim to make these things available to the mourners so that they can buy what they need on the day of Ashura, and they do not suffer from, let's say, from undue hardship on this day, there's no objection to him. He can do so. But what the people think, there are many people think that, okay, doing business on this day is absolutely forbidden. It can be forbidden, it cannot be, it can be permissible, depending on what your intention is. Sometimes, okay, you are, for example, you are working for a company. The company does not allow you to, does not give you a leave to go out and engage in Azadari or to occupy yourself with Azadari. They do not allow you because you are supposed to be there to work in the shift. And So you are not to blame because you have to be there. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, probably you will end up getting fired by the employer. That's exceptional. And the same is the case with people who open their shops in order to make food and drink available for other, for people, for the neighbors. Mm-hmm. There's no objection to them either. Okay, if someone is doing something which is, for example, let's say he is selling cars, he's selling fashionable dresses, or he's opening his salon, cosmetics, selling cosmetics, that's something different, okay? Because on the day of Ashura, you're not going to use makeup or wear cosmetics. And in common view, it's kind of, you know, disregard to Azadari, to Muharram. So if it does look like a kind of disrespect to Azadari and to the occasion of Muharram, then it is not permissible.
I see. Sheikh Javid, what's the Islamic law about carrying, about fasting on the 9th or 10th of Muharram?
Yeah.
I mean, Tasu'a and Ashura.
Fasting is quite permissible on the 9th day of Muharram. And when it comes to fasting on the 10th day of Muharram, of course, fasting is permissible, but it is good. Mm-hmm. It is better to break one's fast after midday by eating something, by drinking something. So fasting is not haram. If a person wants to fast, it's okay. Mm-hmm. There's no problem in it. And you know, Shia Muslims living in and predominantly Sunni populated countries are under the impression that, okay, maybe fasting is recommended. Because according to Ahl-Sunnah, fasting on this is recommended, is highly recommended. Mm-hmm. But that's not the case with Shia Muslims. They believe that, okay, it's better not to fast on the day of Ashura. It's better to eat something.
Is it reprehensible to fast on the day
it
of Ashura?
It is, yes.
But what about Tasu'a?
Tasu'a, there's no objection in fasting.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid.
Sure.
And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. From me and the rest of the crew, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new lands.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.